welcome to episode 35 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops. I'm Jerry Shario, and as usual for the last 34 times, it's my pleasure to introduce to you composer, director, author, playwright of all the podcasts on all the platforms in all the world. He has to host this one. Nick Santamaria.
You must remember this. Now the censors are going to cut that out because I'd have to pay.
Well, yeah.
To use that, but I only used a little bit.
But we have such a budget on this show. I'm sure we could. Never mind.
If you consider the budget of the time I take to put in the research for each episode,
yeah,
you would owe me a lot of money. If I were being paid by the hour, you know,
yep,
or even paid by Misha hour, it would be a good thing. But he would probably pay me in rubles. Anyway, hi, Jer. How are you, pal?
Hey, Nick. I'm doing really good. Yeah. How about you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Are you a little bit more adjusted to being an empty nester?
Yeah, pretty much. Saw our son at his workplace. I don't think I shared this last time. We went to where he works. He works at an aquarium of sorts. It's called the Blue Zoo. Apparently, they are around the country, these places.
What's it called?
The Blue Zoo.
The Blue Zoo.
And it's, yeah, primarily an aquarium, but they have, you know, aquarium-adjacent animals as well. There's this tortoise that's, you know, the size of a Volkswagen and that sort of thing. So my wife and I went up there to see him in his natural habitat, I guess, at his job. And, yeah, he's doing well.
What does he do there?
Basically curates. You know, when we were there, he was in the parakeet cage and talking about the birds, the budgies. And
did
all
he lose
sort
the key?
What?
Yeah. He was there for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
He ate 17 parakeets. When asked about it, he answered, but anyway, that's very interesting. But the Blue Zoo, it sounds like a place to go see caged liberals.
Yeah, could well be.
Of which I would be one. But anyway, and you too, Jer. But anyway, we're not talking about politics here, are we?
No. Far be it.
We are talking about their penultimate film for Universal International. And this one's called Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops. Interesting, because Abbott and Costello did not come from that school. They weren't raised in the movies like, say, Laurel and Hardy were, or the people who actually worked for Max Sennett during those years. Mm-hmm. They learned a whole different way of expressing themselves comedically. And as far as Max Sennett was concerned, it was frantic, throw the plot out the window, you know, fall down as many times as you can, jump up and down at the same time, crash cars into apartment buildings. It's just absolute mayhem. And, you know, it served him well for quite a few years. But we'll get to Max Sennett here when we talk about this. But it's interesting that they chose this for Abbott and Costello. Why they avoided a burlesque-themed film is beyond me. They could have made a very good, you know, maybe a murder mystery backstage, you know, like The Lady of Burlesque, based on Gypsy Rose Lee's novel with Barbara Stanwyck. But they could have done a really sweet burlesque theme movie.
So do you think they would have called it Abbott and Costello Meet Minsky?
You know, something that actually wouldn't be bad.
Yeah.
It would have been more apt to say Abbott and Costello Meet at Minsky's.
Yeah.
You know, which is a bit more apt. But yeah, it's just interesting that it's the Keystone Cops of all people. And it goes back to the silent days in the... I'm not sure when this movie takes place. Because when he goes to see... At the very first scene, when they're watching Eliza on the Ice, or whatever they call it there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually Uncle Tom's Cabin. But that was made in 1927. And, you know, on the cusp of talkies coming in. So I think it was actually supposed to be before that, before 27, and probably in the teens, if they're talking about, you know, what they're showing with the movie making are the musicians on the set and, you know, all the Max Sennett stuff. Yeah. So I'm assuming that it was about 10 years earlier, probably 1915, 1917, around there. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of works because, let's face it, at this point in their careers, they were physical comedians. They weren't crosstalk comedians anymore, unless they were doing their live appearances. But Even in their live appearances, they were tending to do sketches, sketch material, as opposed to just strictly standing in front of the microphone, you know, crosstalk. Mm-hmm. And that's where they went, you know. And I tell you the truth, a lot of people look down on these later films in the 1950s because of the fact that they're not doing crosstalk anymore and they're falling down a lot and it's a lot of stuntmen. But the thing is, they did everything. They did everything. There was nothing more they could do that was new. So this was kind of like something that they had to do. It was a direction they had to take because the other stuff, they were doing it on television already, you know, and doing it to death, I might add. So they had to go in a different direction, and they did. And to tell you the truth, this one works so much better than Jekyll and Hyde. It's actually an Abbott and Costello movie with some very strong support, right? With some strong support by Fred Clark and Lynn Barry and Frank Randall, Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum, and, you know, cameos by the Max Sennett people, including Max Sennett. So there you go. It's a fun 78 minutes. It's not their greatest work, but I did walk away with it feeling better, feeling good. I laughed. And it's just, you hear that theme song and you just want to party. You just you want to dance around the room. Jerry, tell the story about your wife.
Oh, yeah. I was watching the film yesterday, you know, to get ready for the recording. She had never seen it and she was busy coming and going as I'm watching the movie. And about her third or fourth trip through the room, midway through the film, she's humming that theme song. Had never seen it, had no idea what it was about, but it got her, you know?
And I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
It's just the catchiest theme song of their canon, of their complete film career. And it was written by Henry Mancini, of all people. Now, Jerry and I were speaking about this before we started recording, and Jerry actually did the research and looked up that theme was actually written by Henry Mancini. Mm-hmm. And I followed that up with the fact that last night I couldn't sleep, and I actually watched the first three quarters before I did fall asleep of The Great Race, Blake Edwards' film, dedicated to Mr. Laurel and Mr. Hardy, one of my favorite comedies from the 1960s. And Henry Mancini did the music, did the score. And it's very reminiscent of the score of Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops. Yeah. So I put it together, actually, that it must have been Henry Mancini because it was very familiar. So there you go. It's directed by Charlie Lamont. He's back to add his expertise. He works like lightning and keeps it under budget. The budget was $743,000 and 520. I always have trouble doing that. $743,520. That was it. I looked like crazy yesterday, and there is no listing of how much money the film made. Mm. But I did remember reading that this was the second lowest budgeted film Universal International put out for advertising. They barely advertised this movie. Wow. And I think the other one was, I don't know, might have been Feuding, Fighting, and Fussing or something like that. One of their hillbilly comedies that got less advertising. So they were pretty much, you know, resigned to the fact that they didn't have to spend a lot of money in order to get the profits that Abbott and Costello brought in. Yeah. It was an automatic, you know, it was automatic. So it probably made around the same amount of money as Jekyll and Hyde, which was about $1.25 million. And to be honest with you, this was their penultimate. They had one more to go, one more movie for Universal International, and it was over. But Universal wanted to sign them again. But we're going to get to that when we get to the next movie, which is one of their better movies. So script-wise, interesting script. The story written by Lee Loeb, who wrote the script for Jekyll and Hyde, and John Grant got solo writing credit on this script. Mm-hmm. Now, I do believe it because, you know, most of the gags are silent. They could have been in a silent Max Sennett movie.
Oh, yeah.
But basically what I noticed, and this is what I was looking for when I watched it yesterday, there are some really nifty dialogue scenes. There's some nifty jokes in this movie and some that made me laugh. Some of them are from Fred Clark, who is absolutely wonderful in this movie. Almost steals it, I might say. And there's just some nice dialogue. I'm going to point it out when we get there. But, you know, John Grant did his job, I have to say. He did not rely on the burlesque routines. And I'm going to explain something about the opening scene. That's very interesting. It has to do with their television work. So let's get going here. What do you say?
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. It opened on January 31st, 1955. We know that Lou was sick the previous year. He was about to get on a plane to do some political work, some speaking, actually, for Joseph McCarthy. Now, not one of Lou's shining moments, but apparently before he got on the plane, he collapsed. They thought it was from exhaustion. His rheumatic fever was back, and he was back to bed for a long time. They were off the screen for over a year and a half at this point. They had a Colgate Comedy Hour to do, and Lou could not do it, so Bud hosted it on his own and was a very congenial host.
Yes.
You know, no laughs, but he was very congenial. He could have been, you know, he could have had an Ed Sullivan show, or Kevin Brownlow would have, you know, have footage of Bud, you know, here he is, you know, Hume Cronin. Hi, Hume. Oh, hi, Bud. How quiet. What is with you? but yeah. I mean, he was terrific. And they showed a couple of clips from Bud and Lou from previous shows. And then coming out and saving the day were Martin and Lewis, who were not supposed to be on until the following week. And they came on and did a few sketches and stuff in front of the orchestra and helped out. So that worked out okay. And in the meantime, Lou dodged a bullet by not having to do Fireman Save My Child. and the sad thing is they probably would have had to do it. And the boys not reading scripts would have accepted it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this kind of worked out okay. So Lou says that while he was incapacitated, he got more fan mail during that period than he did during his entire time in Hollywood up to that point.
Wow.
And he rightfully so credited that to the television show because people were watching the TV show. So, you know, that worked out nicely. He found out people really did care. So anyway, that's what led into this movie, and they didn't start filming it until June of 1954. They finished a month later in July, and it wasn't released until the end of January 1955. I said the budget, and the studio wanted to call it The Stuntmen, which I think is a really good title. I like it. They didn't want to call it Meet the Keystone Cops because they thought that there was no relevance anymore with the Keystone Cops, that nobody knew who they were. But television saves the day once more. TV started showing the Max Sennett comedies, and all of a sudden, the Keystone Cops were relevant, and Universal International said, yes, let's call it Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops. And sure enough, that's what they did. So anyway, the boys came back, but they also negotiated a new contract with Universal International. Get a load of this. I am relentless. I do have a touch of autism, so I will repeat things over and over. And I will repeat things over and over. see it, but they did negotiate a new contract. Now they were splitting $200,000 and getting 50% of the profits.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. So that's where how they went into this. Okay, so let's begin with their. I love looking at the caricatures of them during the opening titles, and these, you know, it was actually one that they used throughout the entire title sequence. But you had that glorious music, and we should play a little bit for them right now, Jared. Thank you. And during that whole title sequence, you know, we see Abbott and Costello on the motorcycle and blah, blah, blah. The film opens at a Bijou theater during the silent days. And we see Bud, and it's kind of in a long shot. You know, I think that unless you're in a movie theater seeing it on a huge screen, you really don't know whether that's Bud or not. But they do cut to the inside of the theater. And this is where it all begins. And this is hilarious. Lou is, he's obviously a big movie fan. And he is sitting there watching a movie called Eliza on the Ice. And apparently it's Universal's production, 1927, of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, interestingly, as Lou is watching this movie, he's watching seven-year-old Virginia Gray, who later became an actress at MGM and was in Mexican Hayride with the boys. I always say that this is her second movie with the boys, and she's 20 years younger. Very strange. But very prominent in the movie, in Uncle Tom's Cabin, as the villain, is Lucian Littlefield, who is a great character comedian, appeared in silent movies for hundreds of films, early talkies, lots of short subjects. My favorite of his movies would be Ruggles of Red Gap, where he plays the snobbish citizenry, you know, representing the citizens of Red Gap. Anyway, he's terrific. And he works with the boys on the Abbott and Costello TV show about 25 years after this movie was made, the 1927 film. Anyway, so Lou is watching the film, and he's crying like a baby. He's, you know, Eliza is on the ice, the bloodhounds are after her, and Lou is crying, and it's very funny. And next to him is a guy by the name of Bobby Jellison. I don't know if you noticed him, Jerry, but if you're an I Love Lucy fan, during the Hollywood episodes, there was a bellboy character named Bobby. Remember?
Yes.
Very short, chubby yep. guy. Very good. And he's sitting next to Lou the whole time. He has nothing to do but look annoyed occasionally. But there he is, Bobby Jellison. And behind Lou is the great Marjorie Bennett, who I love. Mm-hmm. She was in Jekyll and Hyde as one of the angry women. But she's been in everything. And I love her in the movie Limelight with Chaplin. She's the landlady, and she's terrific.
As I was watching this, that scene, Bobby sitting there next to Lou, he has had one of those faces that I know this guy, but mm-hmm. I couldn't place him. Thank you. Thank you for settling my mind.
You're so welcome. Lucy in my house was like religion. You watched Lucy every night. It was always on just before dinner. And, you know, I know everyone by heart. It's just wonderful. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he was a big part of those Hollywood episodes.
Oh, yeah. And
we all love the Hollywood episodes. They were hilarious. So Lou is playing Willie Piper, and he's crying so much and causing such a disturbance that they throw him out. And that's the time for the stuntman to do an incredible flip.
Yes!
Onto the sidewalk. It really is terrific. So Bud picks him up and starts chastising him, you know, for not meeting him on time and all this stuff. And Lou actually forgets a satchel he had with him filled with $5,000 that he was supposed to take care of for his aunt. He was going to put it in the bank for her. But Bud has other ideas. Of course, there's money involved. So Bud's radar goes up, and it takes him directly to that satchel. So anyway, Lou goes back into the place to get the satchel and creates another disturbance, which is very funny, by the way. And they drag him out again and throw him so the stuntman can do another flip onto the sidewalk. Okay, now, this is interesting. Outside of the movie theater, Bud and Lou have some very snappy dialogue, courtesy of Mr. Grant. And I'd love to play that now.
Willie, opportunity is knocking at your door.
Tell him I'm not home. I went to the bank.
Oh, wait a minute, Willie. Have you no foresight? I can see it up in lights now. Piper's phenomenal pictures. Willie Piper, president. Harry Pierce, general manager. That's what'll happen if you give me the $5,000.
And if I give you the $5,000, I'll be Willie Piper to Portland.
No.
There is some snappy dialogue in this movie, and it actually goes all through the movie. Jerry and I were a little, you know, confused why John Grant got sole credit on this screenplay when there were no burlesque routines, which was his, you know, his want. I did watch a movie recently, a Donald O'Connor movie from Universal International Technicolor called Double Crossbones. And on the script, special material by John Grant. And there's the, if you stand on one end of the handkerchief, I'll stand on the other hand, and you can't punch me in the nose. They use it in this movie. So, you know, you wonder, why do they get John Grant if there's no burlesque routines to draw back on and adapt into the movie? But anyway, just to prove to you that there were some jokes in this film, there actually are. Now, here's what I wanted to talk about as far as television. It's gotten to the point where Bud and Lou know they're going to be on live television on the Colgate Comedy Hour at least six times a year or four times a year, something like that. And we'll get into the television shows later episodes. But they started using stuff that worked really well on the TV show, on the Colgate show. You'll see in our next episode, Meet the Mummy, one of the funniest things they did on Colgate was the necklace and the hamburger bit. And it went over so well that they used it in Meet the Mummy, and it works just as well. It's just wonderful. So this whole thing about Bud, Lou is trying to explain what the movie was like inside, and he falls to his knees, and he's pretending, please don't hit me. Please don't hit me. Please, I'm your son. Don't hit me. And this big guy walks by and sees him begging Bud not to hit him. So this guy beats the crap out of Bud. I mean, really beats him up and throws him into this big flower pot, which crushes under his weight. And he's sitting there like, you know, unconscious. And the guy walks away. Don't let me catch you abusing this kid again. This kid? What is Lou, like 47 years old here at this point?
Yep.
So it turns around where Bud wants to get revenge on Lou. Okay. And Lou is already telling him, take the money. It's yours. Don't worry about it. You know, he feels so bad about what just happened, but Bud won't accept it. He has to have his revenge. So he falls to his knees and he starts pulling at Lou, saying, please don't hit your dear old father. And then Lou falls to his knees and says, I'm not going to hit you. I don't want you to hit me. And the guy sees this and beats up Bud again. Bud keeps getting, he gets the worst of it in this movie. It's almost as if they reversed roles. It's really interesting. Now, some people are saying maybe it's because Lou's health was so precarious that they turned things around and Bud took the brunt of the physical abuse. But the truth of the matter is, it was a stuntman. It didn't matter anyway. You know what I mean? So I don't think I just think they're trying to be different.
Yeah. And I would counter that argument with the fact that in this movie, compared to the last three or four, Lou probably takes more falls himself, not the stuntman once, but, you know, just tripping over a suitcase or what have you, more than he has in the last couple of films. So I don't think it had anything to do with him not feeling well going into this.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You know, Lou even said in an interview around this time, we've done everything. You know, the critics are saying, you know, when are they going to do something original? We've done everything, and they have.
Yeah.
So they're trying something different. Whether it works, you know, as well as the earlier films or not, that's up for conjecture. My only thing was I watched the film. I enjoyed the film. I really like it. I really do. I don't think it's a bad movie. But as soon as it was over, I had forgotten I had watched it. It's like cotton candy. It just dissolves sweetly in your mouth. You know,
except you still have that song running through your head.
Yeah. My favorite is the trombone.
Yep.
Okay, so Bud gets the crap kicked out of him. And again, they did this first on their Christmas show 2 years earlier. The whole thing with Bud getting thrown into the thing and getting beaten up. And I believe it was Gordon Jones. It was Mike the Cop who actually did it. Not playing Mike the Cop, but, you know, doing a cameo. So they used it in this movie. And it works. It works. It's very interesting to see Bud getting the brunt of it. And he does throughout the entire movie. I made a note here that he reminds me of Ollie in the Laurel and Hardy movies.
Yes.
Stan does something stupid and Ollie pays the price always.
Yep. Yep.
It's that way with Bud in this movie. So in a way, again, it's something different. So they decide they're going to invest in the motion picture industry. Bud sees an ad in the paper. Now, he's the stupid one. Bud actually is the sucker. You know, con man Bud is the one being conned. And Lou wants to put the money in the bank. He's the pragmatic one. It's different. It's just different. But I think it works well. So anyway, Bud convinces Lou that they're going to invest his aunt's $5,000 to buy a movie studio in Orange, New Jersey. At least it's near Patterson, you know? So they show up to... No, first they go to actually buy the studio from the guy who's selling it. And that's Joe Gorman. That's his name. And he runs this studio. And he's played by the wonderful Fred Clark. I know we all remember Fred Clark. He was quite a presence in our, you know, our growing up. He was in everything, basically. He really was. Growing up, he was everywhere.
Yep.
Let's talk about him. He was born Fred Leonard Clark in Lincoln, California. I have no idea where that is. Lincoln, California. It might be a place where they cut down trees, you know, Lincoln logs. And he was born in 1914. Now, this is what kills me about him. 1914. That means when I'm watching him in 19, let's say 50, he's 40. He's 40 years old. He looks so much older. He's one of those character actors that looks 20 years older than he is, than he actually was. He didn't live long. He died very young. It's just very strange. Anyway, he went to Stanford University to do doctor stuff. Some people say it was pre-law. Who knows? Maybe he was going to school to sue doctors. Who knows? He changed his name to Malpractice. And that's perfect. But anyway, he got a scholarship while he was there because he was messing around with the theater group. And he got a scholarship to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, where he was voted the most promising actor. Huh. Well, from there, graduating from there, he did some Broadway, some small roles on Broadway before World War II. And then in 1942, he joined the Navy and became an aviator and did quite well in that role. After the war, in 1947, he made his film debut in a movie called The Unsuspected with Claude Rains. I love that, Claude Rains. He's just the best. You know, Johnny. And then he did Sunset Boulevard in 1950. He did How to Marry a Millionaire the year after this film. Actually, the same year this film was released. He was in a little thing called Anti-Mame. He's in what I consider to be the best Martin and Lewis movie. The most successful is Living It Up, where mm-hmm. they do that song. Every street's a boulevard in old New York. Great stuff. And then his last film was The Scorpio Letters in 1967. Interesting about his career, towards the end there, he started making movies for American Independent. Or is that what it was called? Independent
American International.
American International, thank you. The Beach Party movies and all those. He was in Pajama Party, which was one of the first movies I ever saw in a movie theater, and my introduction to Buster Keaton, in fact. And he did a few more of those movies, including Buster's last movie, War Italian Style, which was also American International. And he was also in a movie that I happen to like and everybody hates, and it's called Skidoo. And it's Groucho's last movie. It's an Otto Preminger, horrible, horrible film that I just really, it's a guilty pleasure. And Fred Clark gets stoned with Harry Nilsson in the movie, and it's a lot of fun. But anyway, he did stuff like that. He's also well known for playing Harry Morton on the Burns and Allen television show until he was replaced by Larry Keating. He did lots and lots of television. Married twice, first to actress Benet Venuta from 1952 to 1962. And then eventually he married a model by the name of Gloria Glaser in 1966 until 1968 when he passed away from liver disease at the age of 54. He was only 54. He looked like he was 74. Anyway. So that's our friend Fred Clark, and he plays Gorman, and he's just wonderful. So the boys show up to buy the studio, And it, I love when Fred Clark says, I know you guys want to see it first, right? Before you buy it. And they're both, yes, we want to see this. We want to see it. And he goes, fine, I'll show it to you. And they're all, they get ready to leave. And he pulls out a picture. He says, here it is. It turns out to be the Black Mariah, which was the very first film studio in America, built by Thomas Edison. So they go to West Orange to see the studio. And the Universal International actually built a recreation of the Black Mariah. It looks exactly like it. Mm-hmm. And so the boys are looking at it, and they have their sign, Piper Studios, Willie Piper. Bud is Harry Pierce, by the way. And an old Scottish guy. I really like this guy. I forgot to look him up. I don't know who he was. But he's good that say that Scottish accent, much better than mine. And anything would be. And he takes them over. He goes, two more suckers. And he takes them over and he shows them all the different signs of the suckers who bought this studio. And one of them is Grant Productions, inside joke. But anyway, they learn that the $5,000 has been thrown away on this worthless studio that couldn't be used even if they wanted to. So anyway, they become hell-bent, and especially Bud, become hell-bent on getting to California and finding Joe Gorman and getting their money back. All right. So while they were at Joe Gorman's office, they also met Lynn Barry, who plays his lead actress and also his, you might say, his gangster's moll. You know, she's his mm-hmm. assistant in his, you know, nefarious schemes. And I happen to love Lynn Barry. I have a little crush on Lynn Barry. She was born Marjorie Schuyler Fisher in Roanoke, Virginia, of all places, in 1919. She changed her name to Lynn Barry based on Lynn Fontaine, the actress, and J.M. Barry, who wrote Peter Pan. But then she changed the spelling of it to B-A-R-I because she liked the Italian city, Barry. So she took Lynn Barry. Her dad tried to run and operate a car dealership in the early days, in the 1920s, when she was just like 7 or 8 years old. And he ended up committing suicide by jumping out of a hotel window. I suppose maybe he got the bill. I don't know. I don't know. But he splattered himself on the sidewalk in front of the hotel. So the mother moved Lynn and her brother to Boston, where they had some family. And she eventually remarried a couple of years later to a reverend, Robert Bitzer. And while she was in Boston, she was teased mercilessly about her Southern accent from Roanoke, Virginia. So she started doing amateur theatricals to lose the accent. And she did eventually. I had no idea she was from the South. In 1932, her stepdad is called to be a reverend in Los Angeles. And the whole family moves to Hollywood. And before you know it, she's taking acting lessons. She's seen by a scout at 20th Century Fox. She signed for their talent program, which is a year and a half program where they teach you everything. They teach you how to walk, how to talk, how to breathe, how to recreate scenes from Lemon Pledge commercials, all of those things. I have no idea. The weird thing is she was taught by Broderick Crawford. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, so she's at the training thing, and she ends up getting a 7-year contract at 20th Century Fox. But she gets a lot of bit roles, a lot of uncredited things throughout the 1930s. And once like 1940 comes, everything changes. She actually gains a persona. She becomes the studio bitch. Now, I mean that in the nicest way. Not that she was a studio female dog, but she was the other woman, meaning that, you know, she was that sly, crafty, sneaky, beautiful woman who threatens the relationship of the leading lady and the leading man. And of course, she never wins. She never wins the leading man. And it's usually the good girls are always played by Alice Faye or Betty Grable or Sonia Henie or Broderick Crawford. No, I'm kidding. Major roles in movies like China Girl, Hello, Frisco, Hello, one of my favorite Fox musicals. The Spiritualist, a good kind of eerie movie. Orchestra Wives with Glenn Miller and his orchestra. Mm. And Jackie Gleason is in that one. And Milton Berle, young Milton Berle, is in that as well. She's in what's considered Vincent Price's first supernatural kind of horror movie. It's called Shock. I think that was 1946, I think. And she was with George Raft in one of my favorite George Raft movies, Nocturne. He made a series of movies for RKO, film noirs. Interestingly, she was second to Betty Grable as a pinup during World War II. Second to Betty Grable. Yeah, that's saying something. I'm telling you, she was really beautiful. In this movie, there are some close-ups that, you know, they make it go like that. She did. It was interesting. I was doing that, and my mother thought I was having a stroke. So, anyway, she did lots of TV when her film work started drying up in the late 40s, early 50s. And her last movie was The Young Runaway in 1968. Her last TV was The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and The FBI in Color. And that was... That was 1968 also. She was married to Walter Kane, her agent, from 1937 to 1943. A very unhappy marriage. And as an agent, he only required 10% of sex during the honeymoon. And then she married, interestingly, Sid Luft in 1943 until 1950. Another unhappy union. This was Sid Luft who married Judy Garland right after this marriage, and very famously produced her movies, her later movies, and managed her career and ended up, I think, stealing money from her as well. So they had a daughter together, and tragically, the daughter died the very next day. Yeah, so that had to put a real pall on everything that followed. But anyway, they had a son a couple of years later, John. But by that time, the marriage was dead, and they had this horrible, horrible, painful custody battle that lasted like 8 years before she got full custody of her son.
Wow.
Yeah. Then she married a psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Nathan Rickles. Dr. Rickles, he was a psychiatrist. He used a method where he would insult you and call you a hockey puck and things like that until you just got disgusted and left. But they were married for a long time, from 1955 to 1972. During her later years, she claimed that she was very unhappy in life. All three marriages were terrible. She had a domineering mother who was an alcoholic, who spoiled a lot of things in her life. And during the last 10 years of her life, she suffered from terrible arthritis. And she passed away very young from a heart attack in 1989 at the age of 69. So, yeah, sad, Lynn Berry. And I was sorry to hear all that because she's one of my favorites. I really, really like her. And I think she's very funny in this movie. She has that running gag with Lou. Didn't I see you? No. She was very funny. Okay. So they met Lynn Berry. They went to see the studio. They found out they were screwed. So what does Joe Gorman do? He knows they're going to come right back after him. So he decides on a plan. And it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. He decides to take on a persona, a different persona. And we know that during the silent days, you had some crazy people, especially people like Eric von Stroheim, who would do anything to make his movies more, you know, real. He would have them, the women would have to wear silk underwear. And nobody knew they were wearing silk underwear other than Eric von Stroheim and the actors themselves. But he had to have that. It was that kind of thing. There had to be real wine in the decanters during the orgy scenes, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So this is sort of a spoof on that kind of director. And he becomes Sergei Tumanov, the great Russian director. And he takes on this horrible accent and he wears a toupee and a mustache and, you know, he becomes a different person. So he decides he's going to go and he's taking Lynn Berry with him as his main actress, and they leave for Hollywood on the train. So Bud and Lou find out that he's gone and that he went to Hollywood, and they have to get to California, but they have no money. Now, this is where my friend Ed Watts, the film historian, he wrote the great book about Wheeler and Woolsey, good friend of Matthew Conium and myself. And he said that he loves this movie. It's one of his favorites. In fact, it's on his top 10 list in our book. This is his number one. Wow. He just loves it because it's so different. He loves the slapstick, but he mostly loves that it's something Bud and Lou never did before. It's a buddy movie. It's a road movie. It's the two of them on the road as buddy, trying to get from one place to another. And it's something they've never, ever done. And, you know, to tell you the truth, when he opened my eyes to that fact, it gave like another star to this movie, because that's exactly what it is. So anyway, I find that very interesting. So Bud and Lou are, they start their trek on foot because they don't have money for the train or whatever. So you see them walking, and this is now license to do a lot of Max Sennett type slapstick. This is why I think this movie is clever, and it doesn't get the attention that it deserves, because they take this almost common thread about two buddies, no money, we've got to get from point A to point B, but they interspersed Max Sennett style comedy in between all of that. Mm-hmm. So you've got, it's Abbott and Costello meet the Keystone Cops. It's Abbott and Costello meet Max Sennett. Yeah. And it works. It works. So what I love about this is the Lou getting his foot caught in the train track. Remember? They're walking and they walk through the train tunnel, and a train goes in immediately afterwards. And of course, they're running away from the train when they get to the other end, which is funny in itself. And I kept saying, jump out of the way, get off the train. And they do eventually. They listen to me. So the train goes by. This is, you know, this is like the virtual reality. You can tell them what to do, you know.
Yeah.
Bud, slap Lou. And he does slap him during this sequence. And it's, the slaps are a little weird by this point when it happens. You know, we're so used to it not happening. When it does happen, boy, you know, it's like a stand-up comic who's very clean, who only uses the F-bomb, you know, every so often. And it makes it that much more powerful. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's an odd analogy. So anyway, they are walking and Lou gets his foot caught between the tracks and he can't get it out. Bud goes to the little signal thing to move it so it'll move the thing, and he knocks himself out with the sign, and it becomes even tighter on Lou's foot, and now the train is coming. And Lou is going to be crushed by the train, and Bud is unconscious and can't help him. And this really is a great scene, and I'll tell you why. Because it's a mix of Max Sennett, suspense comedy with the train coming, and Lou Costello's amazing scare takes. He made me laugh so hard during the sequence. It just works like a charm, you know? There was a point in Jekyll and Hyde where he does it. He does the scare thing, and it doesn't work quite as well. It's almost shoehorned in. Here, it works like a charm, and it's very, very funny. I forget how does he get out of it? I forget.
He just pulls his foot out eventually at the last minute. He's able to yank it out of there.
Okay. All right. Well, the yanks are coming, and there they are. I had to tell you one thing that I forgot. It's one of my favorite lines in the movie, and it's between Fred Clark and Lynn Barry when they're deciding to go to Hollywood. And she goes, yeah, but how are you going to get away with that? And he says, in Hollywood, it isn't what you are. It's what they think you are. Truer words were never spoken. I was in Hollywood for 25 years, and believe me, it's true. Mm-hmm. I don't know if John Grant wrote that line, but God bless you, John. That was a great line. But anyway, we're back to Bud and Lou trying to get to California. And I realized one thing I wanted to mention, when Lou pulls his foot out and gets out of the way of the train at the very last minute, it's a really nice process shot.
Yes.
You know, it's not, he's not there at all. It's one of those process shots where the person in question is completely outlined, you know, on the screen, and you see him moving away from the train. It's kind of neat. It works. Mm-hmm. So Bud wakes up from his unconsciousness and sees Lou laying on the side where the train would have hit him, you know, and pushed him off the tracks. And he thinks that the train hit him. So he goes over and he tries to wake Lou up, and Lou will not be awakened. So Bud says, I'll take you to California. I'll carry you the whole way. Now, this is Bud, mm-hmm. right? This is the new Bud. This is the sensitive Bud. So Bud takes Lou onto his back, picks up the two suitcases, and carries Lou for God knows how long. When they get to a certain point, Bud realizes that Lou is wide awake and taking full advantage of him. Bud's about to like really lay into Lou. But luckily, a wagon pulls up, drawn by a mule. It's a very slow wagon, and it's driven by comedian, and I'm holding up quotation marks, Roscoe Ates. Now, Roscoe Ates is one of the least funny human beings on the face of the earth. He did some stuff in pre-code films in the early 30s into, you know, well into the 1930s, and then as a Western sidekick, where he did his shtick, his stuttering shtick. Hi, be right back, you know. And it's, you know, it's Porky Pig material. And it would not fly today, of course, because in a way, you know, it's a little insensitive. But they happen upon Roscoe, and Bud tells him, no, we want to get to California. You're too slow. Get out of here. And they send him away. And Bud gets his revenge by making Lou carry him and the suitcases at that point. Okay. Now they decide they're going to take the train. They're going to hop the train as hobos. And it just so happens that Sergei Tumanov, the great director, who's actually Joe Gorman, who's actually Fred Clark, and Lynn Barry are on the train heading towards California. The boys are actually stowaways on the same train. So they're not, you know, in the regular part of the train. They're like hobos. So this whole thing with the train, it's a stuntman's holiday. I mean, they're running on top of the trains. Bud looks 30 years younger, really slim, you know, and Lou too. Lou looks like he's a young guy running around, but it's fun. It's a lot. I have to say, I'm sorry. I really like the slapstick in this movie. I think it's a lot of fun. They actually jump into one of the cars and Lou keeps popping out again. And it turns out they're in a cattle car.
Hey, Willie, where are you?
Between a porterhouse and the Short Ribs.
So, and when they're let out eventually, two things happen. Number one, Gorman is confronted by those police. Now, the cops, there are two policemen that catch them at this point. And I wrote here in my notes, they are two of the worst actors I've ever seen in a professional film. I don't know who they were. I don't know who they were paying off at this time. I don't know who was bribed. But these guys are the absolute worst. Now, I'm not talking about the two conductors who, you know, lose the dice game to the boys, but the two cops that first confront them. So Gorman and Lynn Barry think they're caught because the guy wants to take them off the train in Pasadena before they get to L.A. So they think they're captured. But the truth of the matter is Frank Randall plays the studio head. And Frank Randall, if people are familiar with Warner Brothers B movies from the late 30s, early 40s, he was a key component to those movies, Frank Randall. He also shows up in a lot of television later on, including the Lucy Show, the later Lucy Show. But anyway, he's terrific. And he wanted to get to Sergei Tumanov before any of the other studio heads did, because they're all waiting in Los Angeles. So he stopped them at Pasadena and signed him to a contract then and there. So Tumanov is already there. He's already working for the studio. Everything's going great. And Bud and Lou, during this time, I should mention, they have a trick pair of dice. The two conductors on the train decide to play dice with them, and they end up losing all their clothes. So you see Bud and Lou get off the train wearing conductor's outfits, while the two conductors, one of which is Henry Kolker, who is one of my favorite big dumb guys in movies, did a few with the Bowery Boys where he plays a big dumb sergeant, you know, in the army. Funny guy, a really funny guy. But I had a question for you, Jerry.
Yes.
Something is brought up at this point. After Bud and Lou leave them behind and they're standing there in their long johns, the two of them, one turns to the other and said, how am I going to explain this to my wife? And Henry Kolker says, never mind your wife. How am I going to explain it to my wife? Now, my question for you, Jerry, is how would you explain it to your wife? Really, I stopped the film and I thought about it. How would you explain that to you, coming home in your underwear?
Well, you know, to me, that's one of those situations where truth is stranger than fiction. And so I would just tell the truth.
Okay. So you get caught gambling. Yeah. And you get caught losing your outfit, which you have to pay for another one. So Wifey Pooh is not happy at this point. You know, but I did think, what would you tell your wife?
Yeah.
Coming home wearing your long johns, you know?
And anyway. I could also never understand why anybody would bet their clothing in a gambling situation. But
I guess when you're desperate, when you run out of money, you know.
And if Bud and Lou are now wearing their uniforms, what about the clothes that they had on? Why don't these two conductor guys put those clothes on?
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. We did cut out a part where the boys end up at a hobo camp where they are cooking, right? But the hobos make it clear that since the boys were stuck in the cattle car, that they smelled horrible. And the hobos left them because they smelled so bad. Hobos. So I would say bums, but I know that Matthew Comanium in England might be listening and it's a different meaning.
Yeah.
But anyway, they do a great Max Sennett gag, the hobos, when they hide behind the tree. There's like six of them, and they all hide behind the tree and then stick their heads out, you know, and it's an impossible gag because they couldn't possibly hide behind this tree. But it's a great gag. Also in this segment is one of my favorite moments, and that's when they eat the bread. And Bud takes his loaf of bread, and Lou takes his loaf of bread, and we do sort of a return to the oyster in the stew from Here Come the Coeds, and the frog in the soup from Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap.
Yep.
And now it's a squirrel in the bread. And it's really, it's a funny segment, you know? Mm-hmm. Ed Watts tells us that it's his least favorite part of the movie, but to me, it's one of my favorite parts. Now, what this is Lou, you know, every time he goes to take a bite, a squirrel sticks his tail out from one end, or the squirrel comes out the other end. Eventually, he bites him and all this stuff. It's typical Lou dealing with a wild animal that he can't control.
Yep.
But at one point, he wants to get a gun, and he wants to shoot it into the hole where the squirrel is, but he doesn't have a gun. So he sees a hunter, and he runs up to the hunter and asks him for the gun, if he could just borrow it for a moment. Now, I see you smiling, Jerry, because I think you know what I'm about to get to.
Oh, yeah.
This guy, well, first of all, they do the thing with, you know, when you go to grab a baseball bat, you put one hand, and then the other guy puts a hand on top, another one on top, and whoever ends up on top is the first one up. They do that with the gun. Now, this guy, he has no lines. And he's maybe on screen for 10 seconds. And that's being generous.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about Joe Besser.
Yes.
Now, when we started writing the book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, when I was watching this movie, you know, to reference it and to make my notes, it was the first time after seeing this movie maybe 25 times, I noticed that it was Joe Besser. He had nothing to do. What was he doing there? Was there a scene? Was there something they cut out? You know, I have no idea. And nobody makes a big deal about it. But this was Joe Besser.
Yep.
You know, back in 49, he was had a major role in Africa Screams. He had a major role in their television series. He was one of Lou's best friends. No dialogue? It's a little weird. But anyway, it's a great punchline to the scene because Lou fires the gun into the hole and it comes out another hole, which leads the bullet right into his ample posterior. Great name for a wrestler. Ample posterior. He's the living end. Anyway, the boys end up in Hollywood. And who do they see showing up actually around the same time they do, but Roscoe Ates in his little slow wagon. Anyway, earlier on, Bud swindled him out of $20 that they needed to borrow. And they do the thing where he says, we'll pay you back. We'll do an IOU. He writes out the IOU for $30 so he can give him $10 interest and then makes Roscoe Ates sign it. and hold on to it, which means it's entirely worthless. Lou is entirely honest about it. And later on, they want to catch up to him to pay him the money. You can see Bud is a little hesitant about that and maybe a little against his natural way of doing things. But Lou insists, and they run after the wagon that they see. And it turns out not to be the wagon. It's not Roscoe Ates. It's two cowboys. And suddenly the wagon speeds up. And suddenly there's a whole tribe of Native Americans coming after them, shooting arrows and shooting guns. And it's a huge scene right out of Stagecoach, you know? And slowly but surely they're trying to avoid the arrows that are being shot. And they see that the two drivers get hit by arrows and they fall off. So the wagon is off on its own with the horses running. But slowly but surely, they get to the seat where the reins are, and they start controlling the wagon while they're being chased by the Indians. It's very tense. And riding along on the side in an open car is Sergei Turmanov, Joe Gorman, yelling into a megaphone, "More action, more action." That's all he says the entire time. "More action, more action." And I'm thinking, what a great director. It's those subtle little touches that he gives the actors, you know, that make it worthwhile watching.
Yeah.
More action.
Okay. I've worked with that director before. Yes.
Have you? I actually had one there on my honeymoon. My wife paid for it. But anyway, I really love the whole thing about the musicians being there on the set.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you know, during the silent movies, whether it was comedy or drama or horror, whatever it was, there were always musicians, usually a violin and a keyboard, playing mood music for the actors. I think it's a great idea, but I love that they, you know, they didn't spoof it, but they had it here and it was very, very accurate. We did skip maybe one of the most important parts of the film, and that's when Mack Sennett shows up to do his cameo. Now, let's talk about Mack Sennett just a little bit. This is a tribute to him, this film. He was born in Danville, Quebec, Canada. His name, this is funny, his name was Michael Sinnott, S-I-N-O-T-T. But he thought it sounded too much like snot, so he changed it to Mack Sennett. He was born in 1880, like I said, in Quebec. When he was 17, he moved into the States and settled in Connecticut, started doing amateur theatricals, eventually moving to New York and getting into some stage shows as a chorus boy and a singer. He wanted to be an opera singer, but he really didn't have what it took. He eventually got involved in Biograph Studios right there in New York. And this was like 1908. And while he was there, he did everything, including sweep up. He was the general factotum of Biograph Studios, really inuring himself into the atmosphere. He used to wait for D.W. Griffith to walk home, and he would walk home with him and pick his brain about directing and film work and editing. And that's where he got his education. Eventually, he became the comedy head of Biograph Studios and made some groundbreaking comedies at this point, mostly based on what the French were doing at the time. And eventually, he got backing, financial backing for his own studio, which he opened in a town called Edendale, California, which doesn't exist anymore. It's now part of Echo Park. But only one of the buildings from that studio survives, and I was there. I did a commentary for the Mack Sennett Blu-ray collection and actually did one of the commentaries right outside the studio. It was really quite exciting. So he started Keystone Comedies. And he did the very first comedy feature film, Tilly's Punctured Romance, in 1915. That starred Marie Dressler, Charlie Chaplin, and Mabel Normand. Mabel Normand was his girlfriend for many years and his starring woman at the studio. She was a early female director and writer and star, quite groundbreaking for the time. Very sadly, she walked in on Mack and Mae Bush, the irrepressible Mae Bush from the Laurel and Hardy movies, the woman who terrorized Stan and Babe in all those movies. But she was actually quite an attractive leading lady back then. And Mabel found her in bed with Max Sennett. There was a fight, an altercation. Mae Bush actually hit Mabel Normand and broke a vase over her head. And Mabel Normand was never the same after that. A lot of sicknesses, a lot of illnesses, a lot of drug use, a lot of scandal. And she died very, very young in 1930. Very young. Max Sennett never married. He was a mama's boy, from what we understand. Lived on his own as a bachelor his entire life. And eventually, he got into sound films, but not comfortably. And he started doing films released by Paramount. It only lasted a year. And then he claimed bankruptcy. He had made some movies with Bing Crosby, by the way. Crosby's very first starring films were short subjects for Max Sennett. And they're very good, by the way. But Bing helped him financially at this point, actually gave him money to survive. W.C. Fields was also helpful in that sense. Eventually, he went bankrupt. He ended up directing cheap films for educational studios, even worked with Buster Keaton in The Timid Young Man in the mid-30s, one of Buster's worst two-reelers. He also introduced Joan Davis to the movie-going audience in a short called Way Up Thar. So he was still finding stars. He was famous for hiring really talented people, like, well, first and foremost, Chaplin, also Harry Langdon, Charlie Chase, Harold Lloyd for a very short time. But I mean, everyone he hired left him because he just wouldn't pay them. He wouldn't pay them the money they were worth. And that's what did him in. That and the fact that he wouldn't change to the modern times. Hal Roach had it down, and that's why he was successful all through the 1930s. Max Sennett didn't have that. He eventually retired and became sort of a Hollywood relic. Very sad, very, very sad. Lived in a small apartment. I think he was at the Hollywood Roosevelt, anyway, which was right in the hub of things. One thing that happened for him in 1932, everybody talks about Laurel and Hardy, you know, the music box winning the Oscar as best short subject in 1932. But Max Sennett was also nominated against them in a movie called The Loudmouth, a two-reeler with Frank McHugh's brother, Matt McHugh. And it's a movie that was the seed for later Columbia movies, popular ones, 1940's The Heckler with Charlie Chase. And then it was remade in 1946, just before Shemp Howard rejoined the Three Stooges. He made a version of it called Mr. Noisy. But anyway, Max Sennett was up for the Oscar that year. Eventually, like I say, he went bankrupt. He was a technical advisor on a movie called Hollywood Cavalcade for Fox in 1939, which also featured Buster Keaton. And he did this movie, The Cameo, which lasted, I guess, 30 seconds, maybe.
Yeah.
He made $1,000 cleaned just for the two lines that he had. Now, my question about this scene is that they should have never showed him grabbing the pie. I think it would have been much funnier. Here's the scene. Let me give you the setup. Bud and Lou walk up to a scene that's being shot with Heine Conklin, who was an original Keystone Cop, but Max Sennett is directing. So Bud and Lou get into an argument. That's Max Sennett. No, that's not Max Sennett. You can't tell me that's Max Sennett. Bud is saying, that's not Max Sennett. So Lou asks, excuse me, are you Max Sennett? And Max Sennett turns around to a guy who's holding a pie. And Max Sennett grabs the pie, and you cut to Bud, and the pie hits him in the face. And Lou turns to us and says, yep, that's Max Sennett. Now, it's a funny joke. It's a great cameo. But if you did not see him grab for the pie, it would have been a surprise. It would have been a shock. And I think the punchline would have been much stronger.
Yes.
So anyway, that's just me. That's just my 50 years of comedy writing. but don't mind me. Now, sadly, in the early 40s, he went to Columbia to ask Jules White for a job. And Jules White turned him down and told people later on that he didn't want to hire a has-been.
Whoa.
I hate that. Yeah, I know. Anyway, he lived out his life again as a Hollywood relic. He got a special Oscar in 1938, given to him by W.C. Fields, and then was, you know, quickly just completely forgotten. He did a movie in 1949, which was sort of a compilation film, not his best work. I think it was hosted by Steve Allen. It's called like Happy Days or something like that. And he died at the Motion Picture Home at the age of 80 in 1960. He also produced a autobiography, which is one of the most inaccurate books about Hollywood ever written. Or ghostwritten, I should say. Anyway, so that's Max Sennett. That's the guy we're honoring here. Now, there's also in this scene, Heine Conklin, who was, like I said, an original Keystone Cop. He was born Charles John Conklin in San Francisco in 1880, the same year as his boss. He was in vaudeville for 17 years before he ever made a movie. And big time vaudeville, the Keith Orpheum circuit. He made movies from 1912, and he's, like I said, an original Keystone Cop. Eventually, like most people who worked for Sennett back then, who were stars, basically, he became a bit player. He occasionally had dialogue. Usually he didn't. He was a familiar face in hundreds of films. He was actually in All Quiet on the Western Front, playing a wounded soldier, which is pretty impressive. But he made really hundreds of films. And it's fun to look for him in movies because he's there quite a lot. His last film was Gunman from Laredo in 1959. And he passed away in 1959 at the age of 84. And then you have Hank Mann, who is also in this film, did a brief cameo. He was born in Russia in 1887. So he was the kid. He came to New York in 1891 at the age of four. He made many, many, many movies with Max Sennett from 1912. He's an original Keystone Cop, made lots of shorts and features in the sound era. Same thing as with Heine Conklin. Heine Conklin was not related to Chester Conklin, by the way. Hank Mann, he worked right into the 1960s. But I have to say that they were all bit roles, and I'm sure they weren't high paying. So he and his wife, Dolly, towards the last years of his life, actually were the building managers where they lived in later years. Yeah. My favorite thing that he ever did was he was Chaplin's boxing opponent in City Lights in what is arguably the funniest boxing scene of all time.
Yes.
Yeah. So he passed away in 1971 at the age of 84. Now, we also are introduced here to Gorman's henchman, Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum. Where did he get the name Slapsy? He actually was a boxer, quite a good boxer. And his habit of using his open hands when he was in there to toy with his opponents caused them to call him Slapsy Maxie. Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum. He was born in Leonard Bridge, Connecticut. In 1906, the same year Lou was born, he was considered a very clever defensive boxer. He had 223 wins, 19 knockouts, 44 losses, 29 draws, and two no contests, and one where he was dressed like a woman and dancing with his mailman. No, I'm kidding. I just made that up just to make it more interesting. he started in movies in 1933 in a movie called Mr. Broadway, and he made some uncredited, you know, bit appearances in the early 30s. Then you find him in a movie called Kelly the Second, which was a Hal Roach movie starring Patsy Kelly and Charlie Chase in one of his two feature films, sound films, I should say. He shows up in Nothing Sacred with Frederick March and Carol Lombard. He shows up in probably my favorite one of his roles in Each Dawn I Die in 1939 with James Cagney and George Raft. He plays a great part in that. He's in Louisiana Purchase with Bob Hope. He made some movies at Monogram. He was obviously under contract for a while. They tried to make a trio like the Stooges out of Shemp Howard, Billy Gilbert, and Slapsy Maxie Rosenblum. And they made three movies together, Three of a Kind, Crazy Nights, and Trouble Chasers. And one is worse than the other. Terrible, terrible movies. I always say this about Billy Gilbert. I love Billy Gilbert, but in small doses. He's better as a supporting character that shows up to do a bit and then disappears. And then he shows up as the heavy in the East Side Kids, Smart Alex, and he plays a gangster named Butch Broccoli, which I love, you know, because if he got hit, like, say, in the head with a bullet and got an injury, broccoli could have been a vegetable, you know. So one of the most interesting titles he was in was in 1967, a movie called Cotton Pick and Chicken Pickers, which I have to find. Based on that title, I'm sorry, but I have to find it. His last movie was My Side of the Mountain in 1969. He passed away of Paget's disease in 1976 at the age of 69, too young. What I also want to see, and I can't find anywhere, is a movie he stars in called Skip Along Rosenblum. And that's 1951, produced by Wally Klein Enterprises. I guess it's independent, but released by United Artists, and it co-stars the boxer Max Bayer, who did a few movies for Columbia, some short subjects. Max and Slapsy were a comedy team. Go figure.
Wow.
Yeah. And in this movie, Skip Along Rosenblum is Max and Hillary Brook, our beloved Hillary, and Jackie Coogan, our Uncle Fester fans. He's in the movie as well. So anyway, if anyone knows how to find Skip Along Rosenblum and Cotton Pick and Chicken Pickers, I would certainly love that. So yeah, we're back to the movie now, and the boys are in Hollywood. They got onto that wagon, that runaway wagon, and while Frank Randall, who is the head of the studio, is there visiting Sergei Tumanov on the set, you know, and this is the big, you know, fight with the Native Americans, and arrows are flying, and the boys are at top speed in the wagon, and he sees them do this stunt that's absolutely impossible. They come to this huge gap, one cliff facing another, but there must be, what, like a quarter of a mile between the two cliffs?
At least.
And they go top speed, actually make it from one side to the other. And of course, it's all special effects and it looks great. But the studio head sees this and they catch up to the boys and he hires them as stuntmen. Now, I find this very interesting because Lou got to Hollywood in the late 20s and was hired as a stuntman at MGM. So this was actually quite meta, if you will. Even if you won't, I don't really care. So the boys are hired by the studio. Sergei and his henchman, Slapsy Maxie, decide that this is a good thing because now they can arrange for the stunts to go wrong and they could arrange for the boys to be killed so his real identity is not revealed. So this is the plot now at this point. The boys are working for this psychotic director who wants to kill them, and they do all these impossible things. So anyway, this is the airplane stuff. Now, here's the deal. They have to go up in an airplane as stuntmen. Now, Bud doesn't have to go, but Lou has to go. And he's dressed as Lynn Barry, as Lynn Barry's stuntman. And this is, again, Lou did this when he was a kid at MGM. He would dress up as Joan Crawford or Dolores Del Rio or Debbie Reynolds. No, not Debbie Reynolds. And so anyway, they have to get in the plane. But Slapsy Maxie makes it a point to loosen all the ruts and all the, you know, the screws on the airplane so it, you know, easily can fall apart. He also has the other plane fixed with real bullets in the Gatling gun, and he tells the other pilot to shoot to kill, you know, because that's part of the plot. And he also supplies them with one parachute, but Bud gets caught up in the plane as it's taking off, and it turns out that the two of them are stuck in the plane. Now, this, I always complain about Bud not doing enough work, you know, not being part of the team when Lou goes out to do all his stuff. Well, I love it. It's the two of them now. And when they're up there and they realize that there's real bullets and all this stuff, it's very reminiscent of Keep 'Em Flying in a way, their problems with airplanes. And they have to jump out of the plane, but there's only one parachute. And this is my other favorite dialogue in the movie. And it has to do with Bud wanting the parachute.
Give me that parachute.
No!
Where's the tube? Outside? I should wear a parachute.
Oh, don't be so selfish. I'll use the parachute first when I hit the ground, then you can have it.
Well, hey, you'll be there before I will.
All right, then I'll wait for you.
Watch out for the first step. It's a high one.
Never mind the first step.
Okay. Now, that's Bud to a T. It's great. So anyway, they do this wonderful process stuff with Bud jumping out of the plane, the parachute opening, Lou jumping out of the plane and landing on top of Bud's parachute, just like in Keep 'Em Flying. And eventually he cuts a hole in the parachute. And Bud keeps yelling at Lou, "Get down from there! Get down from there! Get down from there!" I mean, over and over and over again. And to me, it's just so funny. He reminds me of Tumanoff, the director. More action! More action! Get down from there! So anyway, and you know what? He can't get down from there unless he like grabs a duck who's flying by. That's terrible. So anyway, Lou falls down and is held by Bud. He's holding on to Lou and slowly he falls all the way down and he's holding on to Bud's shoe. You know, Bud is safely in the parachute. Lou's holding on to Bud's shoe and you see the buttons on his shoe popping one by one as the shoe becomes loose. And Lou falls a great distance into the ocean. Now, Sergei, who's been watching this whole thing from his own airplane, is very happy with the results because he knows Lou's going to drown. So when the cameraman asks him, "How are you going to save him?" Tumanoff comes up with a lie. The only thing he can think of. "Oh, well, he comes up on a submarine." And sure enough, Lou comes up on a submarine. So it really is the perfect punchline to that entire sequence. Now, let's just get to the crux of this. It turns out that Frank Randall, the head of the studio, knew all along that Sergei was Joe Gorman. But it turns out that Bud and Lou have become their main comedy team at the studio based on all the funny stuff they did with this airplane. And Tumanoff has to be their director because Frank Randall thinks he's a great comedy director. He's going to keep his salary until he pays back the $5,000, but he has a wonderful position at the studio and he decides, "I'm going to take this. I'm going to go straight." And Lynn Barry goes along with him. "We're going to go straight." So basically, a Marx Brothers scene begins. This is what I call it. This is their Marx Brothers scene. Again, this is like something Abbott and Costello never did before. It's farcical. It's running in and out of the room. It's driving the guy crazy, like the Marx Brothers did in almost every film. So what happens is Bud comes up with an idea. He's going to dress up as a burglar. He's going to get the proof that Sergei is Joe Gorman. So when Gorman calls the cops, Lou is dressed like a cop, complete with a fuzzy mustache and the whole bit, and he's going to come and arrest Bud. And of course, they're both safe because there's no real cop. Well, while this is happening, and this is weird because Gorman continues to be Sergei, even when he's home alone. I don't get it. But anyway, I guess he's a method crook. But it turns out that a real burglar shows up, dressed exactly like Bud. And a real cop shows up dressed exactly like Lou. And there's this whole farcical situation where one runs in and then another one runs in and runs out and another runs in. And it's all mistaken identity. And it's actually quite a good scene. It's actually done very, very well. And I credit John Grant for this. He basically took what he did with dialogue and he made it a physical scene. So really, it worked out very well. So anyway, I'm just going to cut ahead. It turns out that Slapsy Maxi, he still hasn't been paid and he wants his money. So they know that Frank Randall has $75,000 in his safe. Gorman knows about the $75,000. He steals the money. He puts it in a little satchel and tries to get away. Bud and Lou catch them robbing the safe, but lets them get away and decides they have to get after them. So they see a bunch of cops who are just hanging around the studio and they ask for help. And the cops are so happy to help. And they jump in their car and Bud and Lou jump on the car, the paddy wagon, the open paddy wagon. And they take off after Gorman and Lynn Barry. And that begins a truly terrific chase finale. It is so Max Sennett. And with that music behind it, it really is joyous. It's a joyous finale. I'm sorry if you don't like it. I'm sorry about that. I really am. But I really, really enjoy it. And it's got everything. It's got, the running in and out, zigzagging out of trees, and Bud and Lou, racing to not get hit by the train they have to cross, the sidecar getting disconnected with Lou in the sidecar and Bud in the motorcycle, Lou going down in the ditch where all the guys are working. And of course, they all jump out as the, woo, 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 all done, in Max Sennett days, and all done with W.C. Fields in the bank dick. And it's an old gag, but it works.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's just say that after all of this crazy, nutty, Max Sennett style chase, Gorman ends up at the airplane where he's going to make his escape. And the boys wind up in time, grab the money, and Gorman and Lynn Barry and Slapsy are arrested. I was kind of sorry about, because you really get to like Fred Clark. He's really a lovable crook. And I just can't picture Lynn Barry in woman's prison. But then again, maybe I can. well, I'll be back in a minute. Okay. But anyway, they go to jail, and Bud and Lou grab the $75,000 and show Frank Randall, look, we saved your money. Suddenly, the plane propeller starts, and it blows the entire $75,000, which apparently is all in $1 bills. under cranked and fast motion, the money just blows all over the field while everybody scrambles to pick it up. But what I love about most about this, not only is it really a great punchline to this movie, but Lou remains behind and he keeps picking up the money and he keeps running to Randall and handing it to him. Then he goes out to pick up a few more and he runs back to Randall and hands it to him. While everybody else is doing willy-nilly crazy stuff, Lou has a purpose and it's funny. It's really funny. So anyway, that is the end of their penultimate movie for Universal. And it's a goodie. It's a goodie.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't need major advertising. You saw the name Abbott and Costello and you went. That was it. Mm-hmm. Recently, I watched a movie for Eagle Lion Studios, and we talked about them. They made The Noose Hangs High for them, their first independent movie. And this was an Eagle Lion movie, and it was called Cannon City. It has a very, very almost documentary style story about a very famous prison break in Cannon, Colorado. Mm. And it's a really good movie. It's excellent. But at one point, the 12 convicts escape, and they're loose in this really small town. And they show the public scared. And there's one quick shot of the public frightened standing in front of a movie theater. And there it is, Abbott and Costello in The Noose Hangs High. What a shock it was, you know? I'm watching this movie about a prison break and there's an advertisement for one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is it. I give it 3 stars. I give it 3 stars. It was a lot of fun.
Yep.
No great shakes, not one I walked away remembering and thinking about, but I really enjoyed it while it was on. What'd you think, Jerry?
I would agree with you on the rating. Yeah, 3, 3.5. It's up there.
Wow.
In fact, this was one of the first, if not the first, Castle film I ever purchased. Have Badge Will Chase.
I had it.
And I vividly recall when the film came on TV, getting my little cassette recorder out and recording mostly the music, but also, a couple of dialogue snippets and what have you, and then putting together an accompaniment cassette for my silent 8mm Have Badge Will Chase.
Did you have the full version or the small one?
It was the full one.
Oh, you did? Yeah. I had the small one. Yeah, yeah.
So it had both the plane and the final chase scene, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But then there was the other one. I think it was called Hollywood or Bust, where they show most of the train stuff and the buddy stuff. But yeah, it's one of the ones I remember early on as well.
Yeah.
And it really worked in the silent format.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, I spent a large part of my childhood trying to match up sound to those movies.
My God.
But then there were those movies released by Fox that the Laurel and Hardy from the 20th Century Fox movies that actually came with a record, a 33 and a third record, and it never worked.
Nope.
Ever.
I have visions of some tech in a Fox lab saying, let him try to sync this up.
I'll show him. Boy, that Daryl Zanuck was vengeful. But anyway, you imagine him sitting there and saying, I'll get him. But anyway, so that's our Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops.
Yep.
Now, we're about to step into their final film for Universal International. And interestingly, unlike any other of the great film comedians, they did not embarrass themselves at the end. Mm. You know, like Laurel and Hardy had a less than stellar goodbye. Even Chaplin, you know, Keaton, all of them had less than stellar farewells. But Abbott and Costello had nothing to be concerned about. I feel the same way about W.C. Fields. He was the other one. You know, he did Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, which is just so much fun. And his last real hurrah. But anyway, that's the end. And we will be looking at their final meetup with a monster. And I'm not talking about Richard Deacon. And it's actually one of my favorite Abbott and Costello movies. And it's their final one for Universal. And then we will be looking at their other independent film, their final film together, Dance With Me, Henry. And that will lead to Lou's only solo film, The 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock. So we still have a ways to go before we start looking at TV and radio and maybe even their stage work. Who knows? But we've got a lot more. And ladies and gentlemen, please, I'm going to ask you again, subscribe. If you don't subscribe, we look like a small-time cockamamie podcast that nobody listens to. So please press like, subscribe. It takes 2 seconds, takes none of your energy. And I want to thank everyone for the nice words about the podcast. And some people are just addicted to it. I love it. And I just got a really nice fan letter. Very nice fella. Who just says it's his favorite. And our book, he says, is the best book written about Abbott and Costello. And I appreciate that because I agree with him. All right. So let's say farewell. And Jerry, always a pleasure to see you. And I hope I didn't hog the mic too much this time around. Sorry about that.
not a problem. Never a problem.
Okay, bud. You take care. Have a great 2 weeks before we meet again. And you ladies too. And gentlemen, please like and subscribe. And we will see you very, very soon. And that's no idle threat.